Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a brief discussion of compelling legal issues and practical insights. Please note that the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be, nor should it be construed as legal advice. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. Please enjoy the program.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Cross Border Catch-Up, the podcast for global employers who want to stay in the know about cutting-edge employment issues worldwide. I'm Shireen Abijadi, and I'm here with my colleague, Lena Fernandez, and we're cross-border attorneys here at Ogletree. Today, we're going to be talking about what employers need to know about setting up in a new country. Now, Lena, I've had this question so many times before. An organization wants to start conducting business in a new country, and they want to know what do they need to do to get prepared to employ people in a new jurisdiction. Now, some things are obvious, right? You've got to set up a business entity, you've got to open a bank account, you have to enlist a payroll provider and find a benefits broker. These are all really obvious first steps that most people don't miss. Then you've got the documentation. You've got the employment agreements, the employment applications. You've got to figure out the background check rules and all the requirements that go along with it. And then there's the hiring process and what you can and can't ask as part of that. And most people understand that, right? And you do your benchmarking on the benefits, what's market practice, what's best practice. I think most employers have that down. But what else should they be thinking of? And I get asked this question all the time. So we thought we'd talk about today the things that employers need to consider when they're opening shop abroad. So let's start at the beginning, you know, hiring people. What do you need to consider? What are the things you can and can't ask on an employment application? For example, in the UK, they actually split criminal convictions up between spent and non-spent convictions, and you can only ask about the ones that aren't spent.
If you think about Latin American countries, for example, in Mexico, you cannot ask anything about prior criminal history at all, whether it is spent or non-spent. Other questions that may seem a standard practice in the US that are not as a delicate topic as criminal history, you cannot ask. So questions that are unrelated to the job. So in the US, for example, it's very common to ask all employees about their driver license, to provide a copy of their driver license. But for example, in Argentina and Nicaragua, you cannot ask that information unless you're hiring a driver. So if you're hiring someone who is going to be an accountant, who is not going to be driving as part of their job functions, you don't have the right to ask for that information. And if you do ask for that information, you'll potentially face a discrimination claim.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really funny because you've got these jurisdictions where they have a million things that you can't ask. And then it's common practice for a candidate to put their picture on the resume. And so it's this weird balance between having a candidate show you their picture before you've even started the hiring process and you not being able to ask them anything about their background. And then on top of that, you've got all of the requirements within the job description itself. I mean, the EU has just recently passed a directive that's now going to be implemented in the 27 jurisdictions under their own regulations that's going to require that job titles be gender neutral and that applicants are entitled to receive pay information, which is similar to what a lot of US states have done.
Yeah, and the salary ranges are something that are not so common in Latin America. Countries are starting to catch up. There are certain countries that have regulations requiring employers to provide salary ranges, but that's mostly for like a reporting structure rather than information that you would give to the candidates.
Yeah, exactly. And then once you've got the job description and you're identifying candidates, then you have to think about whether there are any rules that mean that you have to treat local candidates differently from expat candidates, because there are so many jurisdictions out there that are now either promoting expat workforce or trying to disincentivize employers to hire expats. In the Netherlands, for example, you've got the 30% ruling, where if you're an expat working in the Netherlands for the first 20 months of employment, if you qualify under the legislation, you can have 30% of your income be tax-free as long as you get it in the form of various allowances, like a housing allowance or an education allowance. And so it's really beneficial for expats. You take jurisdictions like the UAE and the Saudi Arabia, where for most employers, a large majority of their workforce is made out of the expat community. And in those cases, you've got to set up a routine process for how you submit visas for those people. You've got to register their employment agreements with the local labor authority. And then the labor authority's got to check, put you into a wage protection scheme that makes sure that every month you're paying your employees what you said you were going to pay them on the contract. And then you've got jurisdictions like Singapore, which swing the other way, and they're super protective of their local nationals. And in those cases, you've got to post your job on My Careers Future website before you can even think of applying for a visa for an E-pass or an S-pass visa for an expat.
Yeah, and that's so interesting because, for example, Peru also have those limitations as to how to and when to hire an expat. Peru is very protective of their own nationals. So ideally, employers in Peru, they start hiring nationals, and actually expats can only be up to 20% of the company's headcount. And those expats cannot earn more than 30% of the total payroll. So when you have a foreign employer wanting to set up, let's say, an entity in Peru, you got to think about who is going to be the person that's going to be overseeing the operations in Peru. Because if it is a foreign person, you'll have these limitations.
Yeah, and countries in the Middle East now are starting to pass new legislation which increases the rate of local nationals that you have to have in your workforce. So it's a very similar thing, the amortization rate within the UAE as well as Saudi Arabia, which requires employers to have a certain percentage of local nationals now in their workforce, and that will go up now every year. So there's definitely a protection of local nationals there as well.
Yeah, well, that's so interesting because Colombia used to have a similar rule of a certain percentage of the headcount must be national, but the Constitutional Court declared that unconstitutional because it was unlawful discrimination against expats. So now we don't have this percentage for headcount in Colombia. So it's interesting how different countries are moving around protecting or not protecting nationals versus expats.
Yeah, absolutely. And then once you found out whether you can hire the person or not, then you have to figure out what you can do in terms of a background check. In most countries in Europe, the best that you can do is ask the candidate for a police certificate, a good standing from their local precinct. And really, that's only as good as how long the candidate has lived in that particular area. So in most cases, not very good at all.
And that's similar in Latin America as well. So even if you have public information about someone's criminal past, you cannot use that information to make an employment decision. And it's very specific, the countries that first allow a criminal check and also that allow you to use that information for employment decisions. So let's say in Brazil, Argentina, and Chile, you may be able to ask for past criminal history if it is someone that's in a managerial position, that's handling the finances of the company, or that's someone that's going to be in direct contact with kids, but definitely not for all the roles like we pretty much do here in the States.
So, you know, you can't do a criminal check. And then there are really specific rules when it comes to references as well. You get jurisdictions like Germany and Switzerland where employers actually have a statutory obligation to provide references to departing employees. So you think, great, you know you're going to get something. You're going to find out a little bit of history on the employee. And then you find out that references that are provided by employers need to meet certain statutory requirements and that the language has to be favorable to employees so that it doesn't hinder their further professional advancement. And so then what happens in those jurisdictions is there ends up being this codified language of references, and there are codes which have been a certain interpretation of specific grades. There's, you know, very good, good, satisfactory, and not satisfactory. And then reference letters where the employee and the employer parted ways amicably and it was a good relationship, they take the approach of a very good or a good in a reference. And when things were just okay, they end up being labeled satisfactory. And only when things were really bad and it was termination for gross misconduct can the employer even think about labeling something as not satisfactory. So there are such strict rules. You need your own little interpreter to tell you what means what in those jurisdictions. And even then, there's this heightened obligation to not say anything bad about the employees. So you still don't really know where you stand with the references.
Yeah, I mean, there is a similar rule in Colombia. Employers are required to provide a work certificate to those employees who request the certificate. The certificate must contain objective criteria, and it has to, per law, include the start and end date, the salary, and the employee's role. And employers are not allowed to provide information that could harm the former employee's future employment opportunities. So what you said in Germany, that unless you have proven gross performance, you could say non-satisfactory, that would not comply with Colombian laws, because employers are simply not allowed to provide information that would harm the employee's future employment opportunities. And in the event an employer does that, employees could bring a cause of action against the employer.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. And so you end up with a bunch of employees where you really have no good idea of their background, and you've made a decision to employ them. Okay, so employers do that, right? They get the employees into the business, and then you think, okay, what else do they need to do? Now, in the US, you say, okay, well, over a due course of time, we'll start to create our own policies, right? When we reach a certain threshold of employees where it makes sense. But that isn't the case in most international jurisdictions. There are loads of countries that actually mandate that employers set up policies, sometimes before they've even hired their first employee. You take jurisdictions like Belgium or Saudi Arabia, and employers have to create work regulations when they employ one person. And in some cases, those work rules have to be approved by the government. And then you take countries like Chile or Morocco or Norway, Korea, Japan, and they require work rules when you have 10 or more employees. And that's an easy threshold to meet. I mean, most employers, when they're setting up shop, they usually hire 10 or more employees. And then you've got the countries that require health and safety standards as of day one. You've got Canada, Brazil, and Ireland, and Peru. So before employers can even turn on the lights and open the door, they've got to sit down and write policies.
Yeah, and it is not only about writing the policy, you also need to look at what specific rules you need to follow to implement those policies. So in some countries, you just simply draft the policy and publish it on your intranet and communicate it to the employees, and you're all set. However, in other countries, you need to draft the policy, communicate it to your employees, to the work council, if there is a union representative, allow them some time to make comments, or if they have any concerns, you need to like sit down with them and try to like reach an arrangement. And then after that period of sharing the policies, then you have to actually go and register them before the local authorities. And in the future, if you are going to modify those policies, you will also have to follow a specific procedure. So yeah, it's not only about just drafting the policies, it's about complying with local requirements. But there is, for example, in Mexico, it's interesting because It is not mandatory to have internal rules. However, if you want to discipline your employees because they breach your internal policies, you have to have them validated and registered by the local authorities. It will be really hard for you to impose a disciplinary measure without the policy being validated by the local authority.
Yeah, and Lena, that's a great point, right? What about the existing policies? If an employer has policies that are already created, that they explain to their employees are global policies and have global impact, then in order for those to be enforceable, they've got to then go and register them in some jurisdictions if they want to actually hold employees to account for those types of violations.
We need to make sure that the policies are registered as required by law. And in other countries, there's a specific requirement that employment policies must be in local language. So yeah, it varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
Yeah, and the code of conduct's a really good one, because most of the time code of conducts are also tied to global hotlines, and employers will sometimes forget that when they're setting up a new jurisdiction, they've also got to think about whether their global hotline covers that market. You know, are there local numbers that their third-party hotline provider can now apply to that local market? Does that third-party provider of that hotline, if you've got one, do they have local speakers that can take calls in languages other in your new market? So the code of conduct is a great example, because most of the time it's aligned with global hotlines for non-compliance, or even U.S. employers who have got their SOX compliance hotline and want to then have that extend into the new country that they're opening into. And you've got to think, do you have a local number? And is your hotline ready to receive calls in the new local language? So that's a great point. And then to your point, if you actually want to terminate employees based on that code of conduct, you've got to implement it correctly. Otherwise, your code of conduct isn't worth the paper it's written on.
That's right.
Well, I think that's it. That's all we're going to cover for today. But stay tuned for part two coming up soon. And thank you for joining us for today's cross-border catch-up. Follow us to stay in the know about cutting-edge employment issues worldwide.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.